Before that, Dancing Barefoot by Nova Heart. And leave you with the Malka Spiegel track to end the show off. Up next is Language to Language. Hope you enjoyed the show. Enjoy your BC day. And yeah, enjoy the sun. Looks like it's going to be nice for a little bit longer. Yeah, take care of yourselves. I'm going to leave you with this Malka Spiegel track called Back in the Old City.
She wakes up in the morning, just before the day awakes, to the resting of an eager world that waits. For the questions she must answer, and the choices she must make, she alone holds a lamp that lights the way. In the quiet of this moment, when doubt begins to loom, with no one but her shadow, cast worry on her day, she lays back on her pillow and she says, in this place, give me grief. When I feel the tide of doubt, my fears erase. Sleeping dreams await, trusting eyes have faith in my will to go another single day. In the clamor of the midday, when needs are not her own, and she's bending neath the crush of a heavy load, and she wonders how she'll get through, how she'll survive the day, she breathes in deep and says these words. In the darkness with her thought, she lies in the wake of a restless night. When lonely lays beside her there in a grip that holds her tight, she thinks back on the time they had and the little strides they made together in another sea. Together in another single day.
It's Utla, it's Utla. Come on in, all of you. Well, it's good to be back here. I've been away for a while. Everybody calls me Woody. Kaunsanga Hinudiki Ang. In Haida, I'm called Kaunsanga. And as we go along, I'll give you some pointers on some of the pronunciations and how to make certain sounds. So when we talk about language to language, that's our show, language to language, is we're not just talking about languages and translating to English equivalent. When we do that, we lose a great deal. So there is really no language where you can make a direct translation. There's always worldviews involved and also different concepts describe the world in different ways. There's something in here, in this room. It's sort of a scent or something that's causing my throat to constrict a little bit. I don't know what it is, no. But anyway, so I'll introduce myself in Haida. Hotkish is what we call our language, Hotkish. I have three Haida names. Oda Angas, Iskan Kitu Kun, Iskan Kawan Sanga, Hino Di Kiang. Dik is hat aken. Tetlanas hat ayo di eating. Gatsakas diok ala aken. First, I said my three names. Oda Angas is an eagle sitting on a tree with wet feathers drying itself in the sun. That's a person who knows when to let go to fly high above and observe. But like I said, if we make a direct translation, literal translation to English, Othla means to sit down, and Hangas is something ugly. So in English, my would be called ugly sit down. And that's what I was called as a kid. The old people would greet me as Oda Angas, and the younger ones, since they didn't speak the language, it was pretty well forbidden. By the time we started school, nobody was really teaching it anymore. So they would call me Ugly Sit Down. And then later, when I finally graduated from university, it took me a few years. I started in 1959 and graduated in 1972. So when I got home, my uncle, Dika, called me in and he said, I have another name, a new name for you. He said, you never quit. You didn't let anything get in your way. You kept going until you finished. So your name now is Kitu Kun. Kitu Kun is the butt end of the spear. And what that refers to is the time before the ice. There was a giant bear. I guess scientists referred to as a short-faced bear. Anyway, this person was the one responsible for taking that bear. Some people came from the north before the ice. And they were wearing cloaks made of this heavy brown colored fur, and they wanted to learn to travel on the ocean, to walk the water, they referred to it. In exchange, they would teach us how to accept the gift of this giant bear to be used for covering in preparation for the coming of the hard cold, which we referred later to as the black cold, which today is called the Ice Age. The last ice age. So anyway, to be able to defeat this bear, I'll put it that way, not like these trophy hunters that sit off a half a mile away with a high-powered rifle, or like what happened to this lion, where they put raw meat out there to lure the bear in and probably put tranquilizers in there so the lion wouldn't run away. But anyway, so with this man, he carried a spear that was maybe 5 meters, 6 meters long, and would step out and confront this bear and challenge it to come and fight. And the bear would charge. And it had one weakness, if you could call it that. When the bear got within striking distance, it would stop and rear up on its hind legs and then drop down and to kill its prey. Well, that's what this man was waiting for. And he would set the butt of the spear, anchor it, and when the bear raised up, he would guide the spear so that the bear impaled itself on the spear. And so he was facing adversity without, how would you say it? This is a person who makes no big deal out of facing adversity, just faces it with great calm, at least appearing calm. And then the bear impaled itself on a spear. So that was the name my uncle gave me, Kitu'kun, the butt of the spear, because you have to hold fast no matter what happens, because if you don't hold fast, that person is lunch. And then when I finally graduated from law school, when I returned home, my uncle sent for me again. And he said, it's time for you to have another name. He said, I'm going to give you my name. Because I was the first one, the first Haida to bring back a Juris Doctor degree from law school. So he gave me the name Kawan Sanga. Kawan means walking. Sangai is day. So this is a person who walks in the room carrying a newborn child, someone who brings a special day. Now, you've heard in the words I've been using the NG sound. Kawan Sanga. Kauda Ngas. Kitu Kun. Well, that doesn't have it. But anyway, that sound, you'll see sometimes an Asian person with a name tag on it, and the name is two letters, NG. And when I saw a bank teller with that, I said, oh, so your name is Ng. And he started laughing. He said, yes. He said, Europeans always put a vowel in front of it. It's Ng. And to be able to make that sound, and Haida language has a lot of those, a lot of words that end in NG. Whereas if you take Salish and all the Athapascan family of languages that range from subarctic Alaska all the way down to northern Mexico, which is the Apaches and the Navajos, the Salish, the Tlingit, and the Dene people, all language does not have that sound. So if I refer to someone as Daguang, that refers to a dear person. As a person of the Athapascan family of languages would say Daguan. Or if you ever saw any movies with Chief Dan George, you would hear him, instead of saying Sing, he'd say Sin. Instead of Hang, would be Han. Because they don't have that NG sound in their language, whereas we do. And so to make that sound, what you can do is practice by just humming with your mouth closed. Mm, and then open your mouth while you're doing it so the sound continues to come out of your nose. Mm, mm, so that NG sound is mm. So instead of D-A-N-G, we pronounce with the International Phonetic System, is not dang, is dung, dung. So it's a very distinctive sound. And when I introduce myself as Di Kis Hat Akn, Kis is lava rocks that have been fused together to make, it's sort of a multicolored rock, but these rocks have been fused together. So Kis refers to this rock as being a complete unit by itself, or it also can be something very old. Well, Kis Hat'ai. Hat'ai is the word for human, or that's the origin of the word Haida. Hat'ai, Hat'ai. And so the Europeans couldn't say that. They'd say Haida, and the Skidigit people said Haida'ai. So it's somewhere in there where that name comes from. So when I say Kis Hat'ai, that means that I'm a northern Haida from the Alaska side, and our origins are an island we call Kisqai. But even before that, we wintered, I'll say, during the Ice Age at the south end of Haida Gwaii, near an area now called Cape St. James. There's large caves there. But anyway, when the people moved north and they arrived at what today is called Langara Island, it wasn't an island at that time. The ocean level was low enough to where it was connected to Graham Island. But it was referred to as like a rock sticking out of the ground. There weren't many trees on there. So it was called Tis Langai. Tis is sort of half. Langai is that rock sticking out of the ground. So that's what it was called for a long time. And as the ocean level continued to rise as the ice melted and the land began to change from glacial rebound, it eventually was cut off from Graham Island and became its own island, which was called Langara. But anyway, that's where we lived for a long time, at Kaisquai. So we are Kaishatai. Then when I refer to Dio Tzatlan, Dio we're divided into two groups. Our population is called Kwala. Kwala is the entire population. And I am Tzak. Tzak is a word we borrowed from the Dene-speaking people, because at the time before the ice, the eagle was not here on the coast. We had a giant black bird that lived high in the mountains, and we called it Nunkalsh, Nunkalsh, the black-skinned one. And my own assumption is that it was a giant black condor. It was supposedly lived, it was said it lived in the high in the mountains. And so that was sort of our symbol for who we were as eagles, the black-skinned one. But then when the ice began to melt and the people began returning north, this bald eagle came with his Dene people. So we referred to all the Dene-speaking people as Tzakhatai, the eagle humans. And when it came out to our islands, we adopted that as a symbol of our half of the population. The other half adopted raven. But we adopted, in the north, we sort of adopted a Tlingit word for raven, which we called yeet or yash, and they referred to as yeet. So, but our word in Haida for that is huye. Huye is raven, tzak is eagle, but the southern Haidas use the word hoot, which is an adolescent bald eagle. That's before the head turns white. So anyway, so do you, so I'm the is I'm the eagle part. And then when I introduce myself also, it's Atlanas Hat Iodi Aging. Atlanas, that was the name of the village that was on Kaisquai, Tzatl. But before that, it was just called Tis Langai. Until an incident involving a small bird that resides in New Zealand. And in the spring, there are two flyways. It take off from New Zealand and fly across the Pacific. They cross over Hawaii and make landfall around Haida Gwaii on the North American continent area. Then they proceed up into the Arctic and Alaska, where they nest. They have their young. And then when the young are large enough or big enough for the journey, then they return to New Zealand. The other flyway leaves and goes along the coast of Asia and then goes inland and up into Siberia, where they nest and have their young, and they also return to New Zealand. In English, the name of that bird is the Pacific Golden Plover. So if you're curious, just Google Pacific Golden Plover and you'll see what the bird looks like. But anyway, we call it Tsetl. And I asked my uncle, he lived to be 101, my father's brother in Haida. Actually, I would call him father, not uncle, because my uncle is on my mother's side, the Kha. And so anyway, I asked him, how come they call it Tsetl? What is that? And he laughed. He said, we call it Eskimo bird. So that was before it was politically incorrect to refer to Inuit as Eskimo, when in Alaska they're Nupiaq. But anyway, he says that bird goes so far north, that's why they call it that. So I didn't ask him how they knew it went that far north. But there was a lot of trade routes, you know. The people traveled up and down. And actually, there was an area that went from northern coast of British Columbia, somewhere up to around Prince Rupert area, and it crossed all, went up to around Haines, Alaska, and then up into the interior of Alaska, where they traded hooligan grease for moose hides and quite a few other things. And that was referred to as the Grease Trail. And when the Northwest Trading Company, later was the Hudson Bay Company, decided they wanted to get into the interior of Alaska to take missionaries in there and to trade and whatever, the Northwest Mounted Police start using it, and they didn't get permission. And one of the owners of that trail was the Tsetsawits people. Tsetsawits are the inland hunters, we call them, but they're Dene-speaking people. And some of you may know, heard the name Mike D'Angeli. Mike D'Angeli's grandfather was Tsetsawits and Niska. So I spent a lot of time with him when I lived in Juneau, and his family was living in Juneau, Alaska. So he used to tell me these things. And anyway, they the mounted police refused to pay any kind of a price for use of the trail, so it was blocked, so they couldn't use it. But the Crown being the Crown, you know, they carried over the attitudes from the Roman Empire that any citizen of Rome had a right to use any road, and so they forced their way through. But anyway, so that was the Grease Trail, and so we would get word from those people and stories back and forth. And one of the stories I heard from up there was told by a Nupiaq man. When they lived far to the north, there was a long period of time in which they didn't go south. They just stayed there. And one day the old people got to talking about wondering what might be down there because they'd never gone that way. So an expedition of men decided to go and see what was there. So they started heading south, and they encountered something that terrified them. So they turned around, returned home, and told the people that they'd encountered this race of giants. They didn't know what kind of language they spoke because they could only see them in the distance, and they were afraid to get too close, sort of like you didn't want to get too close to a polar bear. But maybe a couple of centuries or so later, they learned that those giants were trees. No trees in the Arctic. So they were terrified of trees. They thought they were giants. But anyway, so these stories go up and down the trail. That's how we know each other. And our names are not simply labels. When a child is born, the parents, the grandparents, other relatives, they pay close attention and they watch this child to see what that child's temperament is going to be. And from that temperament, they give that child a name that identifies to the world how you're supposed to treat this child. And also it tells which family that person comes from, what the crest of that family is, and also the social status. So that first name that was given to me describes an eagle that got a hold of a salmon that was too large and it got pulled underwater. Ordinarily, that eagle would drown because when its legs are straight out, it cannot release its talons. It has to bend its legs to let go. Well, this one had pulled itself deeper into the water. It was managed to let go. It got to the surface of the ocean and managed to get ashore and get some of the water off its wings, off its feathers. Then it flew and it sat on top of a tree, drying its feathers in the sun. And that salmon in Haida we call taun. In Alaska it's called a king salmon, and here it's called a spring salmon, and others incorrectly refer to it as chinook. Actually, that's a French pronunciation of the word chinook. Chinook people are from up the Columbia River. And a chinook is a species of king salmon, I'll put it that way, that's only found in the Columbia River. Its coloring is different. Its back is sort of a tan color rather than the bluish-black color of the others. So it's actually different. So by just giving it a label, and that's the problem with English, is they put a label on something they think they know what it is. So anyway, this eagle got a hold of this large taun, and got pulled underwater, but managed to let go. So this is a person who knows when to let go. And then when it flew and it sat on a tree, the name for a Satlanas refers to eagle sitting in a tree. So that tells somewhat of Delzeram eagle, from the eagle Kualag. I'm eagle. And also because it's sitting in a tree, that I'm of the Tzatlanas people. And so because I'm Tzatlanas, there's a certain social status that goes with that. So when I was introduced, they'd say, this is ugly sit down. People would know where I'm to be seated at a feast. They know what gifts I'm to be given. But also they knew they didn't have to watch me all the time because I would consider the consequences of what I was going to do or what I did. Of course, I got into trouble and I did things that all children do when they're learning. But I was cautious, not to the point of being meek, but just cautious. So the name knows when to let go, to fly high above and observe. So that was the name that stayed with me until, this was 1944, 45 when I got that name. Then I didn't get my next name until 1972 when I graduated from university. And that one is actually a raven name that I can Kitukun, that's the chief's name. And when I find the right raven person, I'm to pass this name to that person. And I think I found him. But anyway, so that Kitukun is from the raven side. But people know from my crest, the Tzatlana one, where I belong. So no matter where I go, whatever village I go to, I just tell my name, they know where I know who I am. So anyway, that's how our names are. They're not simply labels. And sometimes a child is, there was one boy, he was called Skunkdung. That means he sniffs at his food. And that was his temperament. And he tended to be slender. And when he would go to somebody's house and they'd introduce him as Skunkdung, and he didn't eat much, they didn't try to force him to eat any more than he was willing to eat. So that was in keeping with respecting or honoring his name and his temperament. There was another guy, they called him Gladals. Gladals is a person who walks slowly, so they would never try to rush him. What they did was they focused on that person's other strengths. So anyway, I guess we can play some more music here. Maybe we can do some more. What's her name? Phyllis Sinclair. Phyllis Sinclair, I really like her music. So that was Phyllis Sinclair with the, was called A Single Day. And I think that we'll play number four, Our Side of the Line. But anyway, I really like her music, and I like the lyrics of her songs. So here we go.
Point Grey Campus, located on the traditional, unceded Coast Salish territory of the Hunkaminam-speaking Musqueam people.
Did you know know that music legend Neil Young and director Bernard Shakey are the same person? Get to know the other side of Neil Young's creative genius with the Bernard Shakey Film Retrospective at the Cinematheque. The retrospective includes the Vancouver premiere of Human Highway, Journey Through the Past, and Greendale, as well as films by friends Jim Jarmusch, Jonathan Demme, and Hal Ashby. July 31st to August 10th, 1131 Howe Street. For more information, visit thecinematheque.ca.
Okay, we're back. And I gave a short explanation about our names and our families and this sort of thing. Something that's very, very important in Ida. I was kind of violent. I was angry, hated everything, everybody. And I think it was probably the result of so many years of institutionalization. I started school in 1945, I guess it was. I was 4 years old. I was, 1946, because I turned five in December. So anyway, it was the Indian school in the village. So I went through grade 8, and then 1 year public school. I lived with my Cherokee grandparents in California, in the mountains. And then I went to a school run by Presbyterians, 2 years boarding high school. And then I wore out my welcome there, so I was sent to the government school run by Indian Affairs. I graduated from there and went to University of Washington. And I managed to stay for 6 months. The reason I left is I ran out of money. I squandered my money. I had a whole $1,000 to go to school for the whole year. That was to be my room and board, everything, for the whole school year. But I went broke in 6 months. My $1,000, like I said, I squandered. So I went home and worked at road construction, whatever, for the summer. And then in the fall, I went back to school to another residential school in Lawrence, Kansas, called Haskell Institute. And there were students from 35 states there representing 52 tribes. And I started out in welding, but the schools in the states were different from here in Canada because we actually learned trades and a whole bunch of other things. It was one part of the school was called commercial, where they learned accounting and office work and whatever, all those other things. I don't know because I didn't go to that part. But anyway, I was learning to be a welder, and I had one real problem is with the oxyacetylene welding. It's you're using a torch, and you've got molten metal, and you make a swirling. The puddle of metal is swirling as you're moving. Well, a couple of times watching that darn thing, I fell asleep. I guess I hypnotized myself, I don't know, and I caught my coveralls on fire a couple of times. Not bad, you know, just enough to where I decided I better get out of there. So there was another program there called Radio and Electronics. So I went there and I talked to the instructor, and he said, sure. So anyway, the instructor there had been a radio man on a B-29 bomber in World War II, and he was what they called a ball turret gunner. And he was also the radio man. And a ball turret gunner, the turret was sitting on top of the fuselage. So when they had incoming fighters, you know, German fighters coming in, then he would be the gunner up there. And then when the attack was over, whatever, he'd go back to being a radio man navigator. So anyway, he was our instructor. And so for 2 years, well, I started in the fall of 1960, and I lasted about 2 months in welding, and then I went in there. And I left the school in February of 1963. I knew I was going to get drafted into the U.S. Army because I turned 21 in December of 1962. And this was shortly after it was called the Cuban Missile Crisis, where the Russians were taking intercontinental ballistic missiles and moving them to Cuba and U.S. Navy through President Kennedy, intercepted them and forced them to turn back. So anyway, I knew I was going to get drafted into the U.S. Army, and I did not want to go into the Army. And my grandfather asked me, why'd you go in the Navy? And I said, well, if I joined the Marine Corps or the Air Force or the Army, I'd have to wear a necktie. Whereas in the Navy, I just had a neckerchief. And he started laughing. I said, why are you making fun of me? And he said, no. He said, when you said that about necktie, he said, I think you're a reincarnation of one of our kinfolk that was hanged as a horse thief. So that's what my grandfather said to me. So anyway, I enlisted in the United States Navy. I went in February 1963, and I'd already had some time in the U.S. Army National Guard when I was in high school. I had about a month before they discharged me because my parents wouldn't sign my permission slip. So anyway, I stayed in the U.S. Navy in active duty until March of 1967. And I think what bothered me the most was the way that when my enlistment was up, it was supposed to be up in January because I had that extra month from the Army National Guard. So I went into the personnel office and asked when was there some paperwork I had to do. And a personnel officer asked, what are you talking about? I said, well, sir, my enlistment is up on the 14th of this month. And he looked in the record. He said, nobody told you? And I said, told me what? He said, you've been involuntarily extended for a month. So I accepted that. Next month, I went back and learned again I'd been extended. So we were off in some deployment somewhere, and we were returning to the world, back to Norfolk, Virginia. And the day before we entered port, I was called to the personnel office, and the personnel officers hand me a sheaf of papers and says, walk these through channels. I said, what's this? I asked, what's this? He said, you're being released from active duty at 0800 tomorrow morning when we enter port. So I went to the different departments, got the paperwork signed off on, I got a physical exam. And the next morning, we entered port, and I walked across that after brow carrying my sea bag. And when I set foot on a pier, my world had ended. For the past 33 months, I'd been on that ship, and everything was ordered. I knew where I was asleep. I knew when I got my meals. I knew when I got paid. So I belonged someplace. I was somebody. I was doing something important. And now I had nothing. I was walking off that ship completely cut off. I had no direction. I had no ups, no downs, no right, no left. It was like walking into a world filled with cotton. And I went to a locker that was off the base where I had 5 gallons of tax-free booze I'd brought back from other deployments. So I took that 5 gallons of booze and I went to Washington, D.C., where I had a friend who worked in Foreign Service. Anyway, when they'd get back from some sort of an assignment, they had to go through 18 months of psychological evaluation before they were deemed stable enough to go on another one of these whatever missions. So I went to his place, and so we started drinking. And one day he said, if you feel you're losing it, let me know and I'll get out of here. I had no idea what he was talking about. And then one day I felt something just welling up inside me. I could feel this rage just coming up. And I yelled, get out. And he took off out of there. And I have no memory of what happened. I wasn't drunk. I was sober. But I completely demolished that apartment. The table was broken in half. The chairs were broken. The Venetian blinds ripped down. The television was smashed. Just total shambles. And then when he peeked in, he laughed like crazy. I said, what's so damn funny? I said, I can't pay for this. Don't worry about it. He said, but you had a good one, man. And so we were sitting on the floor because I broke the chairs. And we were drinking, and he found a telephone, dialed a number, and talked to somebody on the phone. And a few minutes later, there's a knock on the door, and he yelled, "Come on in." Door opened, the guy leaned in and tossed him some keys and said, "Here's your keys." And he said some numbers and whatever, and then closed the door. And I said, "What takes that?" And he said, "Oh," he said, "my new apartment." He said, "The company expects this, and they fix it up. So just move to another place. Don't worry, you don't have to pay for it." But that rage was in there. I didn't know it was there. And so from time to time, and it was always when I was always sober when it happened, this rage would just, it just totally overwhelmed me. And I end up hurting some people, you know. Never killed anybody, but I guess it wasn't because I wasn't trying. There was always somebody to stop me. So in trying to deal with that, I realized one day that eventually I was going to end up killing somebody. But how do you make this stop? And I remember an old man at home at a memorial feast talking about his nephew who had recently drowned. He said, "The highest compliment you can pay a person is to say, 'That's a kind person.'" He said, "That's how my nephew was. He was just like his old man. He was a kind man." So I thought to myself, how do you become a kind person? And I hadn't a clue. But there was a term in our language that I remembered from a time when those old men were teaching me. And it was "Di gudengail tuna, di gudengail tuna." I have a soft mind. But I had no idea what that could possibly mean, because there were other terms that I used to hear. And in Haida, these are very, very important phrases, and I intend to be teaching some of these, or at least covering some of these phrases over the coming months. Gudengail skunda. It means to keep your being, keep your mind clean. Gudengail skunda daang. Be sure you have a clean mind. When I was a boy, that's what these old men would tell me. Kautla guna. Sit down, dear boy. Aji dal kenda ang sang. I'm gonna show you something. Dunk hilki, prepare yourself. And what that really means is to clean your mind. Gudengail skunda, have a clean mind. And what that means is it's sort of like your mind is like a container of silty, murky, dirty water, and you have to know how to let it settle so that it's clean. And when you get new information, it won't be sullied or adulterated by that impurity that's in there. So that's where I began. But this whole thing of this gudengail tuna, this soft mind, I had no idea what that could be. And I wrestled with it from 1981, well, actually 1979. I quit drinking 1981. But I didn't really learn what that term meant until around 1990. It was at the end of my second marriage. But when I figured it out, it was too late to save that marriage. What it was I came home one afternoon, and my wife was having a nap on the sofa. And I saw her asleep, and I stood there looking at her. And I thought to myself, how vulnerable that person is. How easy it is for me to hurt her. Why do I want to hurt her? She wants to be happy. She has dreams. She has cares. She wants to live a life without stress and fear and pain. So why do I want to do that? And so that's the first time I understood what it meant to have a soft mind. But by the time I figured it out, my wife had already decided to divorce me. And so when we talk about stuff with the mind in Haida, that's, it's not just my mind, that thing that's in my head, it's my being. So if I want to give you support in which it's total and there's, it's unconditional, I would say, Di gudngai tlatska. Di gudngai tlatska. Well, tlatska means to keep your mind strong, to never let fear get in front of you. If you let it get in front of you, it'll overwhelm you. So when I say to a person, Di gudngai tlatska, that means I'm going to hold my mind strong for you because you're standing there, because you're there. And it's unconditional. So when I tell a person that, that means I've making a total commitment. And but you have to be careful of those things. Like, for example, the joke about the pig and the chicken. I don't know if you've heard that. But a pig and a chicken, we're looking at a ham and egg breakfast. And the chicken sort of says, ah, isn't that a beautiful breakfast? And the pig sort of snorted. It's easy for you to say. You made a contribution. I had to make a total commitment. We tell that to our fathers, too. And I work as a co-facilitator in a program called Strengthening Fathers, that the mother has to make a total commitment. You know, the father makes a contribution. So anyway, it's getting, we're running out of time. And so from time to time, I'll be talking about some of these statements and some of these phrases in Haida. Hawit is thank you, Hawit. But it's more than that. I mean, Hawit means calling somebody to you. But there's different ways in which you do that, either Hawit or you can ask that person to walk to you. Thanking somebody, Hawit, as Hau'a, Hau'a, Hau'a de Guang. Guang, that means I'm, how is my spirit? It's sort of, my being is being, is attached to you. It's great. I don't really have time to discuss, to get into it right now because we're out of time. But anyway, so we'll talk again next week. And thank you so much for listening. And I'm hoping that things will go along good for you today. If there was a sunshine award, I'd give every one of you a sunshine award, which means thank you for making my day happy. I'm so thankful my tongue can't say the words. So we'll talk next week.
You're listening to CITR 101.9. Broadcasting from UBC's Point Grey campus, located on the traditional, unceded Coast Salish territory of the Hunkaminam-speaking Musqueam people.
When you join Balloon Club, we guarantee that you will be able to make a balloon poodle within the first day.
Here at the UBC Ant Club, we just like to talk about ants and compare ant farms. It's really cool.
Paperclip Club is all about, well, paperclips mostly.
At Blah Club, you can blah blah, blah 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 blah.
Explosion!
There's only one club worth joining at UBC, and that's CITR 101.9 FM. We got free tickets to shows, whirly pops, professional help in all types of audio engineering, passes to festivals, crazy parties, live band swag. All types of crazy people. Our programming manager rides a motorcycle. There's freestyle rapping, Nardwar the Human Serviette, the vinyl and record libraries, Discorder magazine, free studio recording, and it sure beats the hell out of Paperclip Club, which is a thing that I just made up because I work at
CITR.
So come check us out on the top floor of the Student Union building. We got all types of crazy shit for you to do. Or check us out online at www.citr.ca.
Concerts and CITR present Toronto punk band Metz. Touring to support their latest release, Metz 2, Metz will be playing at the Rickshaw Theater on August 3rd with guests Big Ups and Dilly Dally. Tickets are available at TimberConcerts.com, Red Cat, and Zulu Records.
show de Leo Ramírez, lunes 4 a 5 de la tarde en el 101.9 FM, CITR. The Leo Ramírez Show, Monday, 4 to 5 p.m. at 101.9 FM, CITR.
Dating, which I've been reading recently, and we're going to be talking today in general about relationships, about communication, and about repairing repair is all about. Welcome back to the show, Susan.
Thank you, Marie. It's great to be here.
Thank you for coming back. And so what's been new with you and with 5-Minute Relationship Repair, promoting that? How have you been lately?
Well, everything's going great. The books are flying off the shelves. One thing that we want to urge couples to do, a lot of people read a book and they go, oh, yeah, we'll do this. We'll get to doing some of these practices someday, you know. But I want to encourage people who have bought the book to download the free workbook that's on the website, 5MinuteRelationshipRepair.com. And use those fill-in-the-blank worksheets. They make it real easy to apply the principles in the book. Speaking vulnerably about your core feelings and needs instead of telling the other person what they ought to be doing differently.
Yes.
You know, that's a big difference in your communication. You know, telling the other person what to do versus revealing your needs. That's probably the biggest message in most of our communication teaching.
Wonderful. Well, that actually brings up a question right off the bat, because I have been doing the 5-Minute Relationship Repair with my boyfriend. We haven't finished it, though, because we just listened to, we went to Calgary, and while we were there, we listened to the Dr. Stan Tatkin program.
Right.
And we've been listening to Alison Armstrong. And I have to say, first of all, how awesome it is to have someone who's willing to do this work. But as far as what to do versus revealing needs, one of the problems I'm having is that I'll talk about the needs that I have, and if it's something small, like just a little tweak in communication, it seems like it gets to the point where, like, I'll ask for it and we'll talk about it and he'll kind of get what I need, and then it's not happening, and then I'll ask again really nicely and sort of drop a reminder here and there. And then after, like, the 20th time I'm having to bring it up again, I start to get a bit upset. And it almost seems like in order for him to get it or to want to do it, it has to be, I don't want to threaten the relationship, but it almost has to be that the relationship is on the line for any change to actually happen. Is that normal?
Well, you know, what's really normal, Marie, is to have to ask for what you want over and over and over. I hate to give you the bad news, but that's actually pretty normal. I mean, it depends. Now, if we're talking about agreements, you know, that's a different thing, agreements. But if you have a need like a need to be told reassuring things, you know, told loving things, and your partner, that's not your partner's natural MO. I mean, that's a complaint from a lot of women. You know, I like to be validated.